Good morning, and may it please the court. In a qualified immunity case, if judges could disagree, then we do not expect, we do not require officers to guess at the correct results, leaving them to hope that they pick the winning side to avoid liability. Qualified immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. Now, this court is well-versed, of course, in the inquiry, the two-prong inquiry into qualified immunity. You've had one case on qualified immunity already this morning. And the two prongs are essentially there must be a violation of a constitutional right, and that constitutional right must be clearly established. And I'll address each of those in turn. The first step in a Section 1983 case or the qualified immunity analysis is to identify the constitutional right that is allegedly violated. In this case, ZJ has alleged the violation of her Fourth Amendment right, specifically basing it on an unreasonable search through the use of excessive force. And just to step back a bit, there are two sets of officers here. There are homicide detectives and there are tactical team officers. There are actually 10 officers being sued. And it's important to note under Section 1983 that each individual is only responsible for his or her own misconduct. They're not liable for the alleged misconduct of others.
On appeal, have you separated out that liability by individual officer?
We addressed, each officer and the facts that could have supported. For instance, there was only one allegation against Detective Ray. The allegation was that she participated in a drive-by of the house. Other than that, she is simply a detective that investigated the case. And to briefly discuss the facts of the case to the extent that they matter for the Fourth Amendment analysis and the qualified immunity analysis, on October 29, 2010, Nina Whitney was brutally murdered. She was stabbed at least 22 times, she was strangled, and there was evidence that she was sexually assaulted. The three homicide detectives, here were assigned to investigate that murder. And what they learned was that the victim's cell phone was missing, and so they went about tracing this cell phone. They found that it had made a couple phone calls, one to 11812 Bristol, another to a Family Dollar store. They traced it using GPS. It hit at an area, an 80-meter radius around 118th and Winchester in Kansas City, which includes that Bristol street as well. And they also traced it to an area that has some businesses, including a Popeye's Chicken.
You say they traced it. You're talking about the initial tracing when they located it at after they heard it ringing?
That is when they traced it to the 80-meter radius at 118th and Winchester, yes.
Okay, so you're not suggesting, the Popeyes is not within that?
It is not. They traced it separately to this Popeyes Chicken, or to an area that included this Popeyes Chicken. They didn't pinpoint it down to the Popeyes Chicken. They traced it to this area. They called the phone, and it was they had somebody answer it. It sounded to them like it was in a commercial chicken. Or a commercial kitchen. All of this they used to determine because Lee Charles checked out the address, the 11812 Bristol address that the phone had called. He was employed at the Family Dollar store that the phone had called. And his employer, the Family Dollar store, had 11812 Bristol as his address. And then he worked at a Popeye's Chicken as well, which was in this footprint where the phone had been traced the second time. Now, before that, yes, it had been traced to this 118th and Winchester, where the officers responded to that area when they initially tracked it, and they called it, and they believe they heard a phone ringing in one of two apartment buildings.
Is that what triggered that tracing?
They had traced it to that area. That's how they ended up in that area searching for the phone, is they used the GPS of the phone to get to that area, and when they responded to that area, they tried calling the phone, and that's when they... So based on all of this, they concluded that it was reasonably likely that Lee Charles was in possession of the cell phone. So they applied for a search warrant and a pickup. And admittedly, they didn't include in the search warrant application that they had also heard the phone ringing at the in one of two apartment buildings at 118th and Winchester. And I would submit to the court that's just simply immaterial. And all of these locations that are in the search warrant are connecting the phone to Lee Charles. At that point, they get a search warrant for the place that Lee Charles is most likely to have that evidence, his residence.
But the phone call was to Bristol, not from Bristol. And the other place where you actually had, where the officers knew or believed there was the phone was located, was not Bristol, but Winchester.
Correct.
Right? So you know, if you had added that information in, a location where a phone is ringing and no one answers, presumably, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, that sort of would give the magistrate information that that may be where it's located and it was calling out to someplace else.
And I think that that is perhaps information that could have suggested that the phone at one point was located. Of course, we know that the phone is inherently mobile. If you had called my cell phone over the course of the last 3 days at 1 o'clock in the morning, you could have, or if you had traced the GPS, you would have found it in the Quad Cities in Iowa. One of three residents is there. If you'd have traced it during the day yesterday, you'd have found it in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. If you traced it today, you'd actually find it in my office. I didn't bring it with me, but cell phones are inherently mobile. So the fact that it was in one location at 1 o'clock in the morning doesn't necessarily rule out probable cause for another location. Now, what it may do is provide probable cause for a second location, but it doesn't inherently defeat probable cause in the most likely location that it would be, which is his residence. And again, that's the residence that the computer check showed. It's also the residence that his employer told the police he was residing. And so including that in the affidavit would have simply, and I would submit to the court, including in the affidavit wouldn't have provided probable cause for the 118th and Winchester address either. Or at least I would not want to be defending that warrant. It's an apartment building that had multiple units in it, and I don't think that the officers could pinpoint it down. They couldn't pinpoint it down to one building, let alone a distinct unit within. Having got the search warrant and picking up, they pick up Lee Charles fairly quickly, but what they don't know is whether there are other accomplices, anybody helping him.
Is there any evidence in the record that there were accomplices?
No, there was no evidence one way or the other, and that's because this search occurred on November 3rd, 2010. Like I said, the murder occurred October 29th, 2010. This was very early on in the investigation. They didn't really have any other leads. Essentially, what they had was this cell phone, and that the cell phone, obviously, they had tracked to Lee Charles, but they had not, they didn't know whether there were other accomplices or not. They had a particularly heinous murder that they wouldn't rule out that it could have been done by multiple people. And so they go to the address that they have for his residence to search. And because it's a homicide and because it's a particularly heinous one, they enlist the TAC team to execute the search warrant, which essentially means the TAC team enters the residence, they clear it to make sure.
And was that decision based on the circumstances, or is that in fact a policy to use these teams under most circumstances?
It's a policy for KCPD to use either uniformed personnel or a tactical response. Now, the homicide detectives, because of the type of crimes that they are dealing with, generally use tactical response teams. I suspect that if you ask the property crimes detectives who are dealing with burglaries and other things, they probably use uniformed personnel more than they would use tactical. But the homicide detectives, based on the crimes that they're dealing with, they typically would use a tactical response team to do so. And that's what they did here. They looked at the policy, they got a tactical response team, and they executed the search warrant that evening. The tactical response team approached the house, they knocked and announced their presence, and after a lengthy delay, they start to breach the door. Now, when they start to breach this outer door, the inner door opens, and the individual who opens it steps back. And at that point, they believe that they're compromised. They breach the door, they throw in a flashbang, and they enter. They clear the residence, turn it over to the the detectives to do their search.
Counsel, if they were worried about being compromised, why did they knock and announce?
Because that's what the law requires. Just because they knock and announce doesn't mean that they're not going to, or that they want individuals to see them and have a chance after they've been seen and the individuals know that they're inside to prevent them from entering.
But Ben, here, though, there was evidence that someone came to the door, had keys in her hand. Even one of the officers heard her say, "I'm getting the door, something, I've got keys." So why, you've presented a set of facts, but maybe not the ones in the light most favorable to the plaintiff here.
What the officers knew, and what the one officer said was, he saw the keys in her hand and she may have said keys. Nothing beyond that. It doesn't suggest one way or the other that she was going to open the door. What's undisputed is, once she opened that inner door, she took a few steps back. And at that point, the officers both have concern for their safety, and they also have this additional concern about destruction of evidence. They don't know what's going on inside. What they know is they've been outside the door, locked out for, at least for them, a considerable amount of time, several seconds, enough for the knock and announce requirement, and then for her to get to the door and not open.
What about, you factor in the lack of investigation to determine whether that approach was right? You said it's a homicide investigation, which I think is undisputed, but you've got Mr. Charles in custody for 3 hours, and I understand it's undisputed he was not interviewed, correct? Before the tactical team went to the house?
It's not in the record whether he was interviewed or not. He is interviewed at some point, but I'm not sure that it's in the record.
Point? And so I guess I'm asking is how do we factor in then the lack of some of the investigation? So if there's nothing in the record about interviewing someone who's in custody, there's nothing, I think, in the record that they did any kind of additional investigation as to who lived at the house, what the layout of the home was. Aren't those facts that have to be viewed as well?
Sure, and what they do is they do a drive-by of the residence to ensure that they have the correct one to see what it looks like. Now they've picked up somebody on this warrant, so really for them time's of the essence when they are looking to recover evidence, so that it can't be.
It was 3 hours, right before they.
Right, and I mean I think what the suggestion is that they should have waited even longer, and really that time is for them to get the tactical team together to brief it, to do the drive-by, and then to execute, so they can hopefully find evidence that that connects Lee Charles to the murder of Nina Whitney, or at least to the cell phone of Nina Whitney. To discuss the second point is whether it's clearly established. I want to note that the Supreme Court's made clear that you can't look at this at a high level of generality. And so the Supreme Court, neither the Supreme Court nor this court, has ever found the use of a flashbang in the Constitution. The district court relied on two Seventh Circuit cases. There's in 2013, a Southern District of New York judge said basically that there's no clarity in this area, specifically citing to the Eighth Circuit, saying that the Eighth Circuit had declined to find use of a flashbang unconstitutional. And if judges can disagree, then we don't hold the officers liable. I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Very well. Mr. Waldeck.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Waldeck, and I'm the attorney representing ZJ, who is a minor, 2.5 years old at the time that this event occurred.
Is ZJ the only plaintiff?
Pardon? Yes, she is. That's the only plaintiff I represent, and that was the only action, I think, that was their parents' home that she was staying in at the time.
And she was in the basement, right?
Well, no, she had gone up, started up the steps to go up to the tri-level house to the point where the flash bomb landed, and that's where she was exposed to it. I'd like to start by just saying this, and I won't dwell on it, but this event changed that girl's life. She was 2.5 years old, and now she's fighting post-traumatic stress and other injuries for the rest of her life. And I emphasize this because these flash bombs that are being used, we talk about it kind of cavalier like it's a firecracker on the 4th, but these flash bombs that we're talking about are so powerful that they can melt steel, molten steel. They are so powerful that they can destroy hearing, sight, or the ability to reason as a result of this, and they also can cause deaths. Those are all facts in this case that we know.
Are all the facts about the impact of this flashbang grenade in the record and undisputed?
Yes, it is. It's in the record, so that you can find it quickly, Your Honor. it's part of the expert's testimony with regard to how there's a munitions person who we hired who was an expert to talk about how strong it was.
And what about, was there testimony, too, about the effect of one of these grenades in various sized locations? In other words, a smaller living room would have more impact than a larger warehouse? Or was there any connection between, I guess what I'm trying to say is the nature of this particular house and the damage that something like this could do?
Well, we know there was a fire inside the house. We know that she was in the middle of the house. But dimensionally, no, Your Honor, there wasn't. Excuse me this morning. There wasn't anything specifically about that.
And are these grenades, and forgive my ignorance on this, do they come in different power levels or strengths, or is there one power?
The ones that the SWAT team uses and out. Nick can talk further to that, but I understand there's two levels of it. But basically, the ones that were used in our house are the bigger of the two. All right, now, just quickly to make sure that I won't miss this, the phone was never at the Bristol house.
The phone was never close to the Bristol house. Excuse me.
Yes, I'm sorry.
While we're talking about the flashbang, since we brought that up right away,
yes.
What makes it clearly established that it's unconstitutional to use a flashbang grenade during the execution of a search warrant in a murder case?
Okay. That isn't established. That isn't established. What is established?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Is or is not?
It is not.
Okay.
Yes. But what is established that if it's used under certain circumstances without knowing what the situation is, then that's where the harm comes, and that's what we're claiming. In other words, if the home is sacred and we know we protect people who are in a home, if they're going to be exposed to these, under what circumstances is it, and how do we use it? What are the facts in this case? And it was touched on earlier in the argument. They had arrested Lee Charles. He was in custody for 3.5 hours before this raid ever took place. No interrogation was ever made of him about what the situation was or what any of the salient facts were done. They went ahead under cover of darkness at 7 o'clock after a briefing meeting and went ahead with the invasion of the home when they knew that the phone they were concerned about was not in that home. Lee Charles was not in that home, and that phone was never anywhere near Bristol. And we'll get into the warrant later, but that's the fact with regard to the situation. So let's just put ourselves in this situation. You're the SWAT team, and you're on the stoop in front of this house, and you're trying to decide whether you should go further. We know from the cases that one of the criteria that we're talking about here is to say, okay, under the circumstances, is this necessary because there's somebody that's dangerous in there that may harm people, a criminal or whatever it is? Is this a situation where if they go in, they're likely to incur resistance by them, or that people will be involved in flight and that they'll have a risk to these people, these men that are heavily armed? Well, in this case, as we establish for the facts, we know from the facts that Lee Charles, who was the murder suspect, the fellow that they thought did this, he was already captured. The phone that they weren't sure that they were looking for wasn't at Bristol, the house they were then going to invade with this very dangerous bomb that they're going to throw in there. They didn't, there's no doubt about that. There's no dispute about that fact. And then in addition to that, what do we know about the actual situation? And what we know about the actual situation is they're on the front stoop. And when they come up there, with the lead man there of the seven men that are going to go in there, and they look and see, at that time, Carla Brown, a diminutive young lady who was the babysitter, she hears the noise and comes towards the front door. There's two doors, if I can describe them for you. The two doors are this. If I'm standing inside like Carla was, okay, I've got one solid wooden door. She got that door open so that they could come in and then step back to see what she was dealing with and saw that they were going to come further through the outer door, which I call a storm door. Maybe I'm dating myself. In any event, it's a glass door that you can see through. She could see through that they were coming off. So what she did with those keys, and I don't think anybody will doubt it, she's jingling those keys like this. And what did that convey to anybody with a reasonable analysis of it? I've got the keys, I'll unlock the door. So they didn't even have to go in because Carla was going to let them in. But they, and you don't have to rely on me on this or any of my clients. Mr. Jorgensen, one of the policemen that was on the SWAT team, said, I saw her jingle the keys. I took his deposition. He said, I saw her jingle the keys.
Does the storm door have a key lock on it?
Yeah.
That can be opened from the inside with a key?
It's a double lock, and it's kind of funny. I had to go to the house twice, Your Honor, because it locks. It can be locked from the inside or the outside.
With a key from both sides?
One key from both of them, and their neighbors have the same thing, too, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah, I'd never seen that either. Okay. That's why I asked.
But in any event, she had the key that would grant them entry without anything, without any resistance. Pardon me. Okay, so what did they know further about what the situation was? Well, that's the great frustration that we have as plaintiff's counsel and the plaintiffs, because there was no surveillance, there was no investigation to determine whether anybody was in that house, whether they were going to get hurt, what was going to happen, or whether there were criminals and they should march on. And we have, in this situation, we have the officers dodging this issue by saying, well, we really weren't sure what they were or not. Okay. If you would just think for a second about that the neighbors next door are 50 feet away, an officer could have walked there, not conspicuously, and asked them, who lives in that house? And they would have found out who did live in that house. And who did live in that house, as the evidence will show? An 84-year-old grandmother who was so arthritic that they tried to put cuffs on her after this and couldn't get her arms back there. A 68-year-old aunt who was taking care of her. Then Carla Brown, who was the babysitter, and my client, ZJ. Okay, that's who was in the house. So if they had done some work in advance, they would have known that those are the people there, and they wouldn't have, under any circumstances, thrown that bomb in that room, and they would not have taken any action to do anything but ask them what's going on. The parents arrive. Another thing that's troubling about this, just coming home, the Joneses, from work, less than an hour after they had raided this place, as they ordinarily did. Miss Jones got out and she talked to the officers and they said, well, what about Lee Charles? She said, well, he hasn't lived here for the last year. They're relying on two outdated directories of where he lives to establish that he was in the house. The fact is he hadn't been in the house in a year.
Okay. I thought an employer also told them that he lived at that.
Pardon you, I didn't hear you.
I thought one of his employers also told the police that he lived at that address.
What the employer said at the Dollar General, I believe it was, Your Honor, was that at the time that he applied, that's what he gave for an address, which would have been somewhat remote from the time that we're talking about. Okay, so that's where they are before. They haven't thrown the bomb yet, but they know he's in custody. They've got the phone. It's nowhere near Bristol where they are. Bristol is a block and a half from Winchester. And they go ahead and they say, well, they're going to force their way in. They see the jingling keys like that. At that point, they don't have somebody who's threatening, in fact, of the situation. It's the opposite of that. They have somebody who's trying to cooperate with them to let them in so that they don't tear down the door. Okay. They didn't hesitate. They took ahead with the hooligan, blow through there, and the officers went through the house, saw there wasn't anything of interest. They left.
How, when the officers came through, how quickly did the grenade get tossed? Was it immediate?
It's pretty, I don't know exactly, but let me describe what happened and we can kind of get our arms around it. He, the lead man that had the bomb, okay, he steps forward. So he's going to be stepping forward like I am. And at that time, Carla Brown has stepped back because she didn't get any response to jingling the keys. And he threw the bomb, smoke bomb, or pardon me, actual bomb, over her head, and it landed in the middle of the living room. 15 seconds, 20 seconds, something like that. Seems like to me it might be reasonable for that. And during that time, why, that's when the concussion occurred that damaged JC and caused her problems that she's going to have for the rest of her life. Now, what you want to say, I would hope, is why in the world did you proceed with this when you had no threat of anybody in there that was going to cause any problems? And the proof of the pudding was that, in fact, they tried to cooperate with them and try to get them out in there without tearing up the place.
Is there any evidence in the record why the officers didn't interview Mr. Charles before the tactical team went?
The only thing I can figure is it's one of the great hidden secrets, because I think that would be one of the first people that you'd want to talk to.
So there's just
nothing.
He's
there. He's the suspect, and they've got him right there. What's the story? What did you do? So forth and so on. Nobody interviewed him. They had a briefing before they went in there. So everybody knew who was in custody, what the situation was with regard to the phone and the rest of it. They'd had the phone location for 4 days before that. So that's all the information they had. Now, when we look at these cases that I've seen with regard to this situation.
What exactly is the evidence about when he was arrested? Because it would be typical.
No, it was 3:37 in the afternoon.
It would be typical to Mirandize him immediately and normally to try. Is there any evidence that he refused to talk to him or that they even tried?
Here's what we know is that he was cooperative with them, and that's in one of the testimony. But I don't know. All I know is that Sergeant Eckert, who was in charge of the case for the police department, that she had signed the application to arrest him. And I know that was done, and he was taken to custody, not in the central city, but at another location of the Kansas City Police Department. But what happened after that, there's nothing in the record to show.
So none of the arresting officers were deposed on that question?
We have information that nobody had interrogated him. I'm sorry, I guess.
Nobody even attempted to interrogate him?
There wasn't any, yeah, yes.
I mean, again, it would be sort of standard practice to take down some pedigree information.
Yep.
Is there any evidence about that, one way or the other?
As to that part, no, there wasn't. Okay, I know I'm short of my time, so let me get quickly just to the points that I just think are important to make, that bomb is terribly dangerous. It's thrown in a situation where we have the right to believe that somebody in their home has a protection. And the reason that this happened was because nobody went to the trouble to do some surveillance beforehand. Just basic stuff, like I did when I started my practice in law. If we're going to get something out, we go find out where the people are that we want to make the complaint to or file a petition. And that's done in a neighborhood. And this neighborhood is a nice setup. It really is. So there isn't any problem or any threat for them to go in to do that. What the cases say is, and the two-prong argument is talked a lot about it. The one prong is there excessive force? In the case that's from this court, in which you decided in Rekosek versus Jensen, that a big officer throwing down a little prisoner and knocking out two of his teeth was excessive force. How does that stack up with a little girl that's got the problems that she has and she's going to have them for the rest of her life for a smoke bomb or a bomb that never should have been thrown, and we're talking about excessive force? Then you get to the second problem, which is whether or not, under the circumstances, what a reasonable officer would have done. A reasonable officer would have had some surveillance first in that information before they went further. They would have taken the trouble to follow through with the jingled key before they did that, and they would have obviously realized there was no threat at all. Were those three ladies going to attack them in some ways, those big guys with all that stuff
on? I mean, it's not crystal clear that, number one, they would have discovered exactly who was in the house. There could have been other people in the house in addition to the three people that were affiliated with the murder, right? There's no way they could possibly know that, even if they did canvass.
And that's exactly what we're saying. You don't go forward with something this dangerous without having some idea what it is. And there's no problem to find that out. They could have found it out from the Joneses if they'd waited 55 minutes. Or they could have walked next door to the neighbor and said, who lives in Judge Grunder's house? Okay, well, got this, this, and this. And they would have known that. Then they could have gone from there. And that's the trouble with using these. And in a case in the future, a situation in the future, when they go up and they're confronted with these things, we hope that your finding in this case would say to them, be careful, Do your work out like good policemen do, and you'll save a lot of people a lot of problems. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it, and I offer it to you.
Ms. Henderson, how much time for rebuttal?
Council has 59 seconds.
Fire away.
May it please the court, I will be brief. Reasonableness is judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with the 2020 vision of hindsight. Saying that these people weren't dangerous, all of that is hindsight. Saying that they would have opened the door is hindsight. And I want to also just briefly note, the cases he was citing, talking about this court's excessive force cases, are seizure cases. He's not bringing a seizure claim. He's brought a search claim. And at least the Eastern District of Arkansas, one judge there said in 2012...
But he has brought an excessive force claim, right?
Based on an unreasonable search. He's brought a violation of the Fourth Amendment based on an unreasonable search through excessive force.
Counsel, for purposes of the clearly established analysis, at what point does the excessiveness of the force become obvious? Could they have used a tank?
What's that?
Could they have used a tank?
I would suggest not. But, I mean, there generally has to be a case at least pretty close to on point. That's what the Supreme Court keeps saying, is that in these Fourth Amendment cases, the reasonableness is fact-specific, and there has to be a case pretty close to the facts of this case to let the officers know that what they're doing is violating a constitutional right. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case has been well argued and is now submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That being our final case for argument, court will stand in